The current COVID-19 pandemic has the potential to stop or even reverse the progress made towards sexual and reproductive health and rights for all. A growing body of evidence shows that the current pandemic is already limiting access to sexual and reproductive health care worldwide, especially in low and middle income countries. While in the United States, the pandemic is heightening already existing barriers to health care. I'm Sarah Barnes, and you're listening to Friday Podcasts, hosted by the Wilson Center's Environmental Change and Security Program and Maternal Health Initiative. In today's podcast, I have the pleasure of speaking with Dr. Zahra Ahmed, the Associate Director of Federal Issues at the Guttmacher Institute. Dr. Ahmed has extensive expertise as a strategist towards the advancement of sexual and reproductive health. She also serves as an expert on U.S. foreign policy related to sexual health and reproductive rights. The Maternal Health Initiative recently hosted an event with the Guttmacher Institute to discuss their findings from three recent bodies of work. This event built off past discussions of the groundbreaking Guttmacher-Lancet Commission report and the significance of the Sexual and Reproductive Health and Rights, or SRHR, agenda. Today we've asked Zahra back to the Wilson Center to build upon these past discussions and dive a bit deeper into the current state of SRHR globally, as well as what impact Guttmacher's recent bodies of work could have on current programming and policies. Zahra, thank you for being here today.
Thanks so much for having me.
As we get started, we've seen that Guttmacher's new research has found huge disparities in unintended pregnancy and access to safe abortion worldwide. Can you unravel these findings to share some of the most important and impactful results, and how this evidence could be used to address inequities in access to SRHR globally through both policies and programs?
Sure. Unintended pregnancy and abortion are reproductive health experiences shared by tens of millions of people around the world, irrespective of personal status or circumstance. What differs, though, are the obstacles people face: legal, social, economic, and other. Critically, unintended pregnancy and abortion occur where abortion is broadly legal, as well as where abortion is restricted. To dive into some data, new research from Guttmacher, published in the Lancet Global Health, finds that there were 121 million unintended pregnancies last year. Of those pregnancies, 73 million abortions occurred. So globally, nearly half, about 48% of all pregnancies were unintended, and 61% of unintended pregnancies ended in abortion. Of all abortions, about half, 35 million, occurred in unsafe conditions, resulting in an estimated 23,000 preventable pregnancy-related deaths. A major finding of our research is about the legal status of abortion. This is important. Abortion rates are the same where abortion is broadly legal and where it's restricted, exactly the same. This tells us that abortion is sought and needed at the same rates, even in settings where it's restricted. In fact, where abortion is legally restricted, the proportion of unintended pregnancies ending in abortion has actually increased nearly 40% over the last three decades. So the data are clear. Abortion bans are ineffective, harmful, and dangerous. Today, abortion rates are nearly four times higher in low-income countries where abortion is prohibited than in high-income countries where it's broadly legal. So sadly, most of the abortions happening in restricted settings are unsafe, as people are unable to get services legally and must resort to unsafe means to obtain the service they need. So when it comes to policy actions, we believe strongly that Congress should permanently repeal the 1973 Helms Amendment, which prohibits U.S. foreign assistance funding from being used to support safe abortion services. As someone who spent years working overseas to expand access to healthcare, I know that repealing the Helms Amendment and expanding access to safe legal abortion services is the right thing to do, and that it would contribute to improving the health and well-being of millions.
Thank you very much for sharing all of that data and that commentary, Zahra. Can you speak to some of the technical and political aspects of SRHR? You've started to already, but maybe walk me through what happens when women who want to time and space or avoid pregnancy altogether don't have access to modern contraception.
Sure. In our new Adding It Up 2019 report, which was released just a couple months ago, we looked at the need, impact, and cost of providing a wide range of reproductive health services for the 1.6 billion women of reproductive age in 132 low and middle income countries around the world. Together, these services help ensure that people can decide whether and when to have children, experience safe pregnancy and delivery, have healthy newborns, and have a safe and satisfying sexual life. Access to and use of effective methods to prevent pregnancy has increased over time, and that's great, but the scale of need is actually growing. So today, more than half of all women of reproductive age in low and middle income countries, which is about 923 million, want to avoid a pregnancy. Among these women, about 1 in 4, or 218 million, have an unmet need for modern contraceptive methods. That is, they're either not using any method of contraception or they're using a traditional method. So for many, a consequence of this is unintended pregnancy. And in fact, the vast majority of unintended pregnancies, more than 77%, are to women who have an unmet need for modern methods. And there are persistent inequities in meeting needs for contraceptive services. So today, 43% of women wanting to avoid a pregnancy in low-income countries have an unmet need, compared to 15% in upper-middle-income countries. This is also true by age, where unmet need for modern methods is nearly double for adolescents compared to all women. In terms of other care, many women who give birth in low and middle income countries also do not receive essential maternal health care, including the recommended 4 antenatal care visits. Because the vast majority of maternal and newborn deaths occur around the time of delivery, skilled care at birth and access to emergency obstetric care are critical for saving women's and newborns' lives. However, unfortunately, overall, just 61% of women giving birth receive the minimum of 4 antenatal care visits. Similarly, only 76% of women give birth in a health facility, leaving millions without care. There are also wide disparities in maternal and newborn care across countries. So for instance, only 59% of women giving birth in low-income countries deliver in a health facility, compared to with 97% in upper-middle-income countries.
Well, these numbers of unmet need for contraception are truly astounding. Zara, what policies are needed to improve access?
Yeah, the good news is that it's possible to address these gaps. So if all unmet need for modern contraception and pregnancy-related care were met in low and middle-income countries, there would be approximately a 2/3 decline in unintended pregnancies, unsafe abortions, maternal deaths, and newborn deaths. And it won't break the bank to make these gains. Even a small investment in family planning can have a radical impact on people's health and well-being. The total package of services would cost about $69 billion per year globally, which translates to just $10.60 per person in low and middle income countries annually, or about $4.80 more than current spending. With these limited resources, the full package of essential sexual and reproductive health care could be provided to all women in low and middle income countries. To do this, though, the U.S. has to take two main actions. So first, critically, the U.S. must restore and scale up funding to UNFPA and fully re-engage with multilateral organizations, including the World Health Organization, so that efforts on sexual and reproductive health care are well-coordinated, well-funded, and well-implemented. And second, the U.S. must increase funding for bilateral global family planning and reproductive health programs so that the U.S. actually does pay its fair share, which is about $1.66 billion per year. And I know that may seem like a large number, but it's actually just 0.2% of the U.S.'s annual discretionary defense budget.
Okay, continuing on and talking about the U.S., how could the newly proposed expansion of the global gag rule impact women and families around the world?
In the middle of a global pandemic, the Trump administration is trying to make it harder for people to get the sexual and reproductive health care they want and need. A few weeks ago, the administration announced that it's proposing to expand the dangerous and harmful global gag rule even further than it already has. So for those not familiar with it, the global gag rule is a destructive policy that prevents foreign NGOs that receive U.S. funds through grants and cooperative agreements from using their own non-U.S. funding to provide abortion services, information, counseling, referrals, or advocacy. The proposed expansion of the policy would, for the first time ever, cover all contracts that organizations have with the U.S. for global health work, not just grant funding. It would also double down on the current negative impacts and push sexual and reproductive health care even further out of reach for many people around the world. From our side, earlier this year, Guttmacher published a peer review study documenting some of the early stage harms of the Trump administration's global gag rule in Uganda. The study found that the global gag rule led to a reduction in the number of community health workers engaged in family planning work. And these health workers are the critical backbone of the country's healthcare system. So having fewer of them could result in reduced contraceptive use and an increase in unintended pregnancies, among other negative outcomes. Importantly, our study suggested that emergency stopgap funding from foreign governments likely mitigated the worst impacts of the global gag rule on the ground. But unfortunately, these interventions may not be sustained over the long term, especially if the U.S. continues expanding the global gag rule to even more partners and programs, and the COVID-19 pandemic exacerbates needs.
Thank you very much for that description and diving in a bit deeper on the global gag rule. So, okay, let's go back now to Guttmacher's research. Given that these findings reflect the state of SRHR before the COVID-19 pandemic, how do you see global reproductive health needs being addressed during the pandemic? Are needed SRHR resources being diverted to the COVID-19 response? And how can SRHR be safeguarded during the pandemic?
It's a great question. Our team estimated how sexual and reproductive health outcomes could change following only a modest decline of 10% in access to care. And the implications are staggering. So a 10% decline in sexual and reproductive health care in low and middle income countries would equal an additional 49 million women with an unmet need for modern contraception, an additional 15 million unintended pregnancies, an additional 28,000 maternal deaths, an additional 168,000 newborn deaths, and an additional 3 million unsafe abortions, as well as an additional 1,000 maternal deaths due to unsafe abortion. These estimates are shocking, but the reality could be orders of magnitude worse if more than 10% of services are compromised or disruptive. And the impact is likely falling heaviest on people who already face structural and systematic barriers to care, even before the pandemic, because these inequities are being exacerbated under the weight of this global crisis. So policies and relief efforts must address the specific needs of marginalized people and populations. So to your question about what needs to be done to safeguard SRHR, we recommend that policymakers take 5 key actions. First, they have to define and promote sexual and reproductive health care, including safe abortion, contraception, and maternal and newborn care, as essential. Second, alongside private sector actors, they have to shore up and strengthen the national and regional supply chains to make sexual and reproductive health medicines and supplies more accessible to both patients and providers. Third, they have to make contraception available without a prescription, decentralized distribution, and facilitate multi-month dispensing of pharmaceuticals. Fourth, they really should adopt innovative models of care, including telehealth, and prevent the diversion of resources and staff away from sexual and reproductive health care. And finally, as I mentioned earlier, they have to address the unique needs of vulnerable and marginalized populations, given all of the barriers they're contending with, which have been exacerbated by the pandemic. To get us to a world when everyone benefits from high-quality, comprehensive SRHR, a wide range of stakeholders have to act, including non-governmental organizations, foreign governments, donors, and global institutions. But truly, given the size and scope of the U.S.'s influence, progress has to start here, and Congress should lead the way in charting a course towards comprehensive services for all. Let me just close by saying that people are complex and they live multifaceted lives with changing sexual and reproductive health needs. And the global community, including the U.S., must enable people to have access to the full range of services that support those needs and address the barriers that prevent people from accessing care. Doing so is a smart investment, but it's also the right thing to do.
Thank you, Zara, for your insights and commentary. This has been such an important discussion, and I really look forward to continuing our conversations on SRHR. It has been a pleasure speaking with you today.
Thank you, Sarah, and thanks so much to the Wilson Center for all your support and interest.
And thank you to our listeners for tuning in to this edition of Friday Podcast, and to the Guttmacher Institute for your continued support and partnership. To learn more about the Guttmacher Institute's research from our recent event, visit the .mom column at newsecuritybeat.org or follow us on Twitter at @Wilson_MHI. If you enjoyed this podcast, please subscribe to Friday Podcasts wherever you listen to podcasts.